Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Sam Pizzagatti, who is a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and his most recent article is A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Pizzagatti.
Thank you.
And on this Labor Day, of course, one always turns to reflect upon the condition of labor in this country and the condition of the representation of labor. And invariably, it ends up in a sort of lament at how the representation of unions in labor have diminished to the point now where they're about 6% of the public sector. And it's hard to understand how, pulling back at a broader picture, Sam, to see how money is so well organized in this country, but people aren't. And what's your, you know, off the top of your head, explanation for that?
Well, it certainly seems that way now. The labor, as you noted, the private sector trade union membership rate is now under 7%. It's higher in the public sector, but there are vast swatches of this country where there's virtually no union presence at all. But I think the thing to remember is that this is not a law of nature. This is not an eternal situation. That years ago, in the middle of the 20th century, we had a much more vibrant labor union. And that vibrant labor movement of the middle of the 20th century came out of a situation very much like our own today. You know, it's 2012, but it could be 1928 and 1929 in terms of the labor presence. Back then in the 1920s, labor had gone through a period where the forces of money, big money, had essentially crushed the trade union movement inconsequence. But labor came back, and I think labor and the trade union movement can once again come back.
In your article, Sam Pizzagatti, A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage, you point out that the minimum wage today, the federal minimum wage, is 7.25 cents an hour, and that back in 1968, the minimum wage workers took home $1.60 an hour. But if you adjust that for inflation, a minimum wage worker today would be earning $10.55 an hour by 1968 standards. So in effect, the minimum wage workers today are taking home almost $7,000 a year less than the minimum wage workers took home in 1968. That is definitely, you know, a sign of that we're not moving forward, right?
Yes, and in fact, I was a minimum wage worker in 1968, and I remember my paychecks with the $1.60 hourly wage, and it's striking to think how much more that wage in terms of real purchasing power back then was worth compared to the purchasing power of the minimum wage today. The last minimum wage hike took place in 2009, so essentially minimum wage workers have been losing ground to inflation ever since.
Well, in contrast, all the statistics indicate that the wealthy and the super wealthy have been making out like bandits, particularly since about 1980. Their share of the American pie has gotten so big that it's reached obscene proportions. For example, just one family, the Waltons, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, they own more wealth than the bottom 40% of all Americans.
That's right. And the Walmart CEO is making over 800 times the salary of the typical Walmart worker right now. We've seen an enormous redistribution of wealth up. One easy way to think about this is that since the late 1970s, the incomes of the top 1% have doubled after inflation. But if you look at the incomes of the top 1/10 of 1%, those have tripled after inflation since the late 1970s. And if you go up even higher to the top 1/100 of 1%, those incomes have more than quadrupled after inflation since the late 1970s.
Sam Pizzagatti, again, a veteran Labor journalist, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and his most recent article is A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage. So we've just been witnessing last week the Republican convention in Tampa, Florida. And believe it or not, the call from the Republicans was that they've got to break unions, that the unions are too powerful, that they've got to rein them in. I mean, what planet? On their platform, it's all about weakening the power of unions. And we know Citizens United decision, even though it gives a nod to union money, there's no question that corporate money outstrips union money by, you know, probably a factor of 100. So,
it's very interesting that if you look at the Republican platform for 2012, in the past, all the Republican platforms of recent years at least paid lip service to the value of collective bargaining. But this new platform pays no lip service to collective bargaining at all. It is a total anti-union platform with no ifs, ands, and buts about it.
And that is obviously the pioneer, if you will, of this anti-public employee sector union movement is Governor Scott Walker, who spoke early at the convention.
Yes, and he was surrounded by a number of other governors who have taken almost as hardline stances against labor rights as he has.
But it still has the feeling, to me at least, Sam Pizzagatti, that it's a part of this whole kind of Republican boogeyman strategy to move the goalposts to the right all the time. You know, they've invented this myth of the liberal media. And, you know, I'm speaking to you from the Pacifica station in Los Angeles, and Pacifica is the liberal media, right? But it's, you know, very powerless and, you know, suffering from its own internal fratricide. So nobody can tell me that we have a powerful liberal media in this country. It's just a huge lie. And equally true, nobody can tell me that there's a powerful union movement with big union bosses, as the Republicans like to say, throwing their weight around. Is this just a part of that kind of cynical strategy of creating a bogeyman?
Yes, it certainly is. And the we need to go beyond talking about the cynicism that we saw at the Republican convention and actually talk about the outright lies that came from the podium from a variety of speakers, lies about Medicare, lies about taxes, lies about all sorts of the things from convention speakers. You know, the Romney Ryan ticket is based on some very simple deceits, and I hope by the end of the campaign those will be very clear and plain to most of the American people.
And what do you think it is then that, just going back to my original question, Sam Pizzagatti, is why is it that money is so well organized and people don't appear to be? We know that the Republicans don't get elected unless they get Democrats to vote Republican, and that's this phenomenon known as the Reagan Democrat. And in many ways, it looks like Paul Ryan was chosen because he's been fairly consistently elected in a blue-collar district in Wisconsin, although it's not really that blue-collar, but at least it's not a traditional Republican safe seat. You know, and he, by the way, Ryan goes out of his way to talk about his union buddies and the people that worked in the factory that was closed, and the lie that he told about Obama closing a factory that happened during George W. Bush's watch. So he's definitely practiced at that. What do you think will reverse that phenomenon of the Reagan Democrat that is essential for a Republican victory?
Well, I think there are fewer and fewer Reagan Democrats across the United States that I think the record of the last 30 years has made sort of clear to most white working class people that the that the Republican approach really offers no big gain. And I think the Republicans realize that, too, and that's why, you know, so much of their effort is about mobilizing their base and suppressing as much of the other, rest of the vote as they can. I don't think they have a winning message any longer. I think people know what happens when we follow the precepts of trickle down. That doesn't work. People have seen it doesn't work. But we need to push in the other direction. And the recent article that I've done, A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage, talks about one of those directions. And that comes from Larry Hanley, who's the president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, which is a national bus drivers union in the United States. He's calling for a maximum wage. He's calling for creating an income cap tied to the to the lowest wage, to the minimum wage. And I think that's a very exciting proposition, just the sort of thing we need to do, need to talk about to begin to reverse the situation that we have now. We need to capture people's imaginations. We need bold plans. And I think talking about a maximum wage tied to a minimum wage is a wonderful way to start doing that.
Well, there's no question that these corporate CEOs can literally write their own checks, and they do. And there's this phenomenon of buying back stock, which is entirely unproductive, but it results in CEOs being able to reward themselves with billions and billions of dollars. And as you point out in your article, Sam Pizzagatti, A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage, during World War II, President Franklin D. Roosevelt called for what amounted to a maximum wage when he urged Congress to place a 100% tax on incomes over $25,000 a year.
And the idea for that came from the CIO labor unions led by the United Auto Workers. The labor movement during World War II pushed Roosevelt on this, and he went along with the labor movement. And at one point, the Gallup opinion polls were showing a plurality of Americans supporting the idea of an income cap on the rich.
So give us some more details then of how a maximum wage would operate.
Well, there are different ways that a maximum wage could operate. You could say that you can create a 100% top marginal tax rate and tax all income over 10 or 50, 100 times the minimum wage at a 100% tax rate. If you did that, then the very rich in our society would have a vested personal interest in increasing the minimum wage, because the higher the minimum wage, then the higher the maximum wage threshold. So 100% tax is one way of going about that. There are other ways that we could take steps in that direction. We could say, for instance, that the government will sign no contracts with corporations that pay their top executives over 25 or 50 or 100 times what their lowest paid workers make. Every large corporation in the United States today depends to a significant degree on government contracts and subsidies. If we took those away, if we tied those to an internal corporate pay ratio, that would have a definite impact. We could also stop subsidizing excessive CEO pay. We could say that corporations will no longer be allowed to deduct off their paychecks any corporate compensation that's over 25 or 50, 100 times what their workers are making. And indeed, Congresswoman Barbara Lee from California has legislation pending called the Income Equity Act, which would do just that. Her legislation would prevent corporations from deducting off their corporate income taxes any corporate compensation, corporate executive compensation, that runs over 25 times the pay of a company's lowest paid worker.
So, Sam Pizzighetti, how would you deal with the capital gains and the in carried interest, which is how Mitt Romney has gotten so rich and pays so little taxes? And that applies, of course, to all to the hedge fund managers. Clearly, because this we have a political system based on money, and the power of money has been able to essentially buy Capitol Hill. And so they've written the tax laws to benefit themselves, where, you know, they get paid, you know, 15% for capital gains and carried interest. In some cases, they don't pay any taxes at all. And as you know, Mitt Romney has not been particularly forthcoming about his taxes, so we don't quite know about the many years that he hasn't disclosed.
That's right.
So how do you deal with that?
Well, it's very simple. Capital income from capital gains should be, and capital gains are the profits you make when you sit, buy, and sell assets, stocks and bonds and gold or whatever. Those profits that you get, the income you make from the buying and selling of assets, should be subject to the same tax rate as wage labor. There should be no special preferential treatment from capital gains. And indeed, when the U.S. Federal income tax first started, there was no special treatment for capital gains.
So the long and the short of it is, what will it take to get your proposal here, a bold new call for a maximum wage enacted and changes to the capital gains structure?
It'll take what it took to create middle-class America of the mid-20th century, and that's a strong labor movement, a revitalized labor movement. And here on Labor Day, it's a great time to rededicate ourselves to the task. Until we have a stronger labor movement in the United States, until we build that stronger labor movement, we're not going to have any sort of real significant social progress.
But as you were saying earlier, Sam Pizzighetti, that labor was reduced down to next to nothing before the Great Depression, and then it was built back up as a result of the Great Depression and the policies of FDR. Is that to say that since we're in the Great Recession and perhaps even on the brink of a new depression, is that what it's going to take?
Well, it could be. You know, I'm always an optimist, and I hope we don't need to fall into an even deeper recession than we're in now. You know, we'll see. Again, on Labor Day, what better time than this to think about and to start working toward a strong, vital labor presence in the United States?
Well, Sam Pizzighetti, I thank you so much for joining us on this Labor Day.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sam Pizzighetti, who's a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and his most recent article is A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.